Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can Homer Simpson tell us about America? Since the show The Simpsons made its debut on the fledgling Fox Network in January of 1990, its writers have produced more than 500 original episodes featuring the Simpson family, along with a vast array of oddball friends, neighbors, and relatives living in the fictional city of Springfield. Because the show is animated, its characters never age. But as my guest today will tell us, that has not kept the show from being a timely and often brazen reflection of the issues of the day. Using humor to soften the blow, or more often to sharpen the sword, The Simpsons has taken on everything from race and religion to social class and same-sex marriage. Matthew A. Henry has seen and analyzed the show's entire history. He is professor of English and Cultural Studies at Richland College and author of the new book, The Simpsons, Satire and American Culture. Matt, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So you say that at its heart, The Simpsons is really a sort of send-up of those 1950s and 60s sitcoms where family life in America was completely idealized. Talk a little bit about the things that those shows put forth that The Simpsons flip over 100%.
Well, I don't know if they flip them over 100%, but they certainly challenge some of those ideas. The 1950s sitcoms posited this very, as you said, idealized, very sheltered and protected kind of world. And they, too, were a reflection of the dominant belief systems, dominant ideologies of the time, primarily of the very strict gender roles that were in place. It was a patriarchal structure.
Father knows best.
Father knows best. That
doesn't fly in our house necessarily.
that title speaks volumes. But the gender roles are very clearly defined. Father was breadwinner. They were also a reflection of a middle class aesthetic. They were part of this consumerist ethos in the post-war era. I think that The Simpsons, I think Matt Groening himself, as a young kid, was challenging some of those ideas himself. And by the time he got around to creating The Simpsons, it was a way of speaking back to what seemed a lot of falsity, a lot of illusion about not only what a family is and how a family operates, but about value systems in American culture.
So The Simpsons employs a lot of parody, but you say the show is best really classified as a satire. Can you talk about the difference between those two, how they intersect on the show, and why satire is really the correct, if you had to choose a category, where that's where you'd put it?
It is where I choose to put it, certainly. I appreciate the show as a satire more than I do as a parody. If you were to sort of scientifically analyze the episodes, I think you'd come away saying, well, it's much more of a parody than a satire. The vast majority of the humor on the show, I think, derives from parody. It's really how it's made its mark. It was well known for incorporating allusions to all sorts of well-known, both highbrow and lowbrow forms of art, literature, music, what have you. I was more interested in what the show was doing as a satire. And the way I talk about it in the book, I see parody functioning as a technique of satire, that it's used sometimes for satirical purposes. But there is a healthy amount of satire on the show. That was also a part of the first few seasons that many commentators wrote about in some of the journalistic reports on the show. And I picked up on that thread. I mean, it was one of the things that I recognized and appreciated. Many of my friends and colleagues, I was in college at the time as an undergraduate, we were impressed not only by the parody, which we recognized and we could get the humor of that and say, you know, feel ourselves a little bit sophisticated. Oh, I catch that reference to Hitchcock, you know. but it really was the satire. It was the way in which it was speaking to some of these more important thematic things and the beginnings of the, you know, what I call the culture wars in American culture. And that's really what I was most interested in exploring, partly because I really appreciate how satire as an art form operates, using humor to kind of hook people, but still dealing with often very controversial, very provocative kinds of issues.
So place The Simpsons for us, if you would, in the sort of grand tradition of satire in Western literature and in American literature in particular.
Well, in the Western tradition or in the American literature tradition, it harkens back in many ways to Mark Twain, for example. In the book, I talk about the contrast between British forms of satire, which I don't think are necessarily the models for much of what goes on The Simpsons. In the 20th century, there's a lot of precedent in film, literature, and television for the kind of satire that is being offered on The Simpsons. I think the creators of the show are they're very well-educated men. They're mostly men, at least early in the early years were, know these traditions very well. And they're picking up on some strains that were evident in stand-up comedy in the post-war period. In the early days of television in the 1960s, for example, we saw a little bit of satire coming into television in something like the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, a little bit later in Rowan Martin Laugh in some of those shows. But those were sort of short-lived, and it was very hard to put that kind of comedy on commercial television. There's still a difficulty in doing it. I mean, there's a tension there between commerce and art, if you want to call this kind of satire art. But they're looking back at those traditions of speaking back to the power structure that's existing at the time.
Hypocrisy is a frequent target on The Simpsons as well. Are the writers able to recognize, in some cases, what might appear to be their own hypocrisy and sort of deal with that?
I think they do. There's a very self-conscious kind of humor on The Simpsons. It's self-referential. It was one of the things that early on when I was first looking at the show through a more academic lens, I paid a lot of attention to. I've since sort of kind of lost interest in that focus. But early on, at that time in the early 1990s, a lot of the conversation in academic circles was about theories of the postmodern, about postmodernism. And one of the elements was this hyper self-referentiality, you know, this constantly looking back at oneself or one's own material.
Worst episode ever, that kind of thing.
Those kinds of things. And so the writers do that a lot. They do it with Homer Simpson in particular. So he becomes the kind of butt of his own joke in many ways. But they do that, I think, with themselves. They've, in the past, for example, have incorporated, you know, animated versions of themselves into the show and have somebody kind of poking fun at those writers. So that's a way of kind of, you know, self-mocking or being a little tongue-in-cheek about their own role in the creation of this kind of material.
How did a show with a decidedly left-leaning philosophy end up on Rupert Murdoch's fledgling Fox Network?
It's a very interesting history, actually. The show's producer, James L. Brooks, who had a history in television with, most famously perhaps, the TV show Taxi, also with the Mary Tyler Moore Show, had been asked to come on board in the very early days when Fox was trying to establish itself as a challenger to the big three networks. And that at the time looked like something that wasn't even going to happen. I mean, excuse me. They were derided for attempting to establish a fourth network. One had not been established or attempted to be established since the DuMont network in the 1950s.
Which didn't last long.
It didn't last long. And so people were very skeptical and they were mocking of the idea. So Fox was willing to be very experimental in what kind of programming they were going to put on. At the same time, Rupert Murdoch, who had already started to establish a kind of media empire here in the United States with newspapers, was looking to branch out. He had acquired, I want to say it was in 1984 or 1985, a half interest in 20th Century Fox Film Studios. And he did that in part looking forward to the idea of establishing a new television network because it would give him built-in material to show on that network. And then he set about trying to gobble up small both UHF and VHF stations around the country and successfully did that. He was able to put together a string of affiliate stations, and so then they needed programming. Well, they had some of the programming already built in from 20th Century Films, but they needed original programming. And they started with some fairly predictable things. Television talk shows, for example. The best sort of failed example was the Joan Rivers talk show.
And they started out just on weekends, right, with original programming.
Yeah, originally Friday and then moved to Saturday and then a Sunday evening programming. And it was only a few years later they finally got out to 7 days a week. So once they were looking for new programming, they turned to James L. Brooks, Barry Diller, who had been working at Paramount previously. Turned to James Brooks, and he promised him complete creative control and freedom. He said, you can do anything you want, no questions asked, there would be no censorship. And Brooks saw a good thing, and he said, okay, it's worth taking a risk, see how this plays out. So that's partly how this kind of subversive material got onto Fox. Once it was there and became the almost overnight sensation it was, I mean, after its first season, it got so much press, so much media attention, so much criticism from certain quarters, that it started to be, it started to create a brand identity for Fox, and of course, it was a cash cow. So once that was in place, I think that the powers that be, meaning Rupert Murdoch primarily, didn't really care so much about the satirical or subversive content as long as the show was generating a lot of revenue, and it continued to create more and more revenue. So there's really been a pretty comfortable working relationship between the creators and the producers of The Simpsons and News Corp.
It's interesting to see Groening and the writers sort of pushing the buttons when they can, though, of the Fox network. And you point to this example, which there's a Fox News helicopter flying along, and it says, not racist, but number one with racists. And I'm going to make no comment on the statement, but certainly one would think that the Fox News organization would object to that.
And they did, actually, openly. And they have. There's been precedent a couple of times. That is a more recent example. That was either 2010 or 2011, shortly after the sort of formation and rise of the Tea Party movement and the shift in the midterm elections in 2010. And these are the kinds of sort of pointed political barbs that the writers would insert into the show very often. And that particular sequence, I think, was aimed to comment on what the writers at least thought was a common belief within the larger demographic of the Tea Party. And, you know, many people have commented on that Tea Party and that fringe element of the Republican Party have pointed out that it is predominantly older white males, older white Christian males. And so this was a critique at the pointed at them. There was a response. The Fox News affiliates, many of them were quite upset about this and spoke back. There was a time prior to that when something similar had happened in an episode, I think in 2003, and the Fox News in particular was very upset at the way in which they were being parodied, if not satirized, again, for some fairly kind of conservative and right-wing ideologies. And they actually initiated a lawsuit. This was right around the time that Al Franken's book, Lying Liars, and I can't remember the exact title.
Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them. Was
yeah.
That
and had been sued, the publisher was being sued for copyright infringement because they were stepping apparently on the catchphrase of Fox, which was fair and balanced. Mm-hmm. And so that was already in operation. Then The Simpsons came along with this little bit on this episode, Mr. Spritz Goes to Washington. And oddly enough, Fox News was trying to initiate a lawsuit against the creators of The Simpsons. So you had two entities within Murdoch's empire having a legal battle with one another.
My guest is Matthew A. Henry. He's professor of English and Cultural Studies at Richland College and author of the new book, The Simpsons, Satire and American Culture. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can get on the line now to join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Matthew A. Henry, professor of English and Cultural Studies at Richland College and author of the new book, The Simpsons, Satire, and American Culture. You can be part of the discussion by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. You say that the Simpsons are not WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, but McWASPs. What does that mean?
Well, that term, McWASP, is partly my own invention, although it's something that I modified from a colleague years ago. Had given me something she'd worked with in her class and dealing with socioeconomic class. The distinction that I wanted to make was, you know, that concept of WASP had been something that had long identified normative American identity. Many people think of themselves or think of American identity through the lens of being white. It has a long history in the country. And what was often left out of that are these other norms that go along with that, Christianity being one of them. That is pronounced in WASP as Protestant, but also middle class status. And particularly in the post-World War II environment, right, the baby boomer generation, the onset of this new consumerist society, expansion of the society, that term WASP was still being used by historians, by sociologists, by others to identify what was considered to be the kind of key to understanding American identity and the norm to which one should ascribe. And so the assimilationist history of the United States was still being pushed using that idea. I wanted to refine the idea to make it simply more precise, more accurate. It was inaccurate by that point and had been even earlier to talk about Americans as Anglo-Saxon, though there's an Anglo-Saxon history, though some of the original settlers or founders of the nation had come out of British ancestry. There was already an enormous amount of diversity even within the category of white among white ethnic groups from Europe. And so by the middle of the 20th century, it was much more accurate to talk about white assimilated identity because many people had or had wanted to assimilate into that dominant idea to be accepted in the culture. So I came up with that term MCWAS, which is middle class, white assimilated, suburban Protestant. And I added the suburban simply because of the expansion of the suburbs in the post-war era, to still talk about what I see as a very narrow and exclusionary ideology. It's simply a more precise way to think about it than WASP was.
It's also a nice little allusion to the term McMansion, and I don't know if that was part of your thinking as you worked through this.
Not so much McMansion, but McEverything, mm-hmm. right? The sort of shorthand for everything that's part of the consumer culture in which we live, and implicitly the kind of dumbing down of many things in the culture in which we live.
So, Matt, Homer has had the same job at the nuke plant for as long as the show's been on the air. They live in the same house. But it is your sense that The Simpsons started out as a sort of blue-collar family and moved up fully into the middle of the middle class as the show went on.
Very much so. In one of the chapters in the book, when I talk about socioeconomic class, one of the frustrations I've had is with the way in which many people perceive of The Simpsons as a middle-class family. And they do so in part because all the trappings of middle-class identity are there. They do own a house. That house is in the suburbs. They have actually two automobiles. And they also, you know, again, going back to your question much earlier, they fit that pattern of the traditional nuclear family. Right, where Marge is a stay-at-home mom for the most part, though she does work outside the home on occasion. Homer is the breadwinner. And so in all of these ways, they appear to be middle class, and at first glance, they might be. That fits in very well with what's on most television sitcoms, which reflects a middle class aesthetic and a kind of norm. But if you look closely at the show, particularly at its start, you can see very clearly that they are a working class family. They are a struggling family, and economics are central. The most telling of that, I think, is the premiere episode, which was actually a Christmas special that aired in December of 1989. In that episode, the entire plot is about Homer's struggle to provide a happy Christmas for his family because he does not earn enough money. That year, he's denied his bonus. Little bit of money that Marge has squirreled away over the year ends up getting used to remove a tattoo that Bart gets at the mall. And the rest of the episode is about this struggle to make ends meet. And Homer resorts to theft, right, in order to provide the proverbial happy ending that we expect, especially from Christmastime television shows. So that was very clear, and that whole first season in the spring of 1990, episode after episode, you can go into it and you can see that it's a constant thread, a constant theme that they are struggling to make ends meet, that it's very hard for them to get by day to day or week to week. A little bit later in the series, we actually see a copy of Homer's paycheck. It's a very interesting choice the creators made, you know, to consciously show us that. And if you do the calculations, you can see that he is clearly a member of the working class. They're not poor. They're still fairly well above the poverty line for a family of four at that time. But they are very much at the lower end of the working class.
Do you think any of that shift has to do with the fact that starting out, I mean, Matt Groening had some success, but I'm guessing his writers were people who were just hoping to, you know, to be attached to a project that would catch on, and then suddenly they had relative wealth?
Yes and no. Most of the writers in the early years are people who were already coming from fairly elite backgrounds. The vast majority of them were graduates from Harvard. So they were already pedigreed individuals. I think, and I don't want to presume too much about their own experiences or what they put into the show. But I think as the show became more popular, it started to reflect more of a middle-class value system, in part because that was already there for the writers, and in part because it's something that the audience is always being told to aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
For better or worse, in this country, we don't talk much about the working class. You were discussing this a little bit in your last hour. We in many ways, denigrate the working class. We try to pretend that there is really a much larger group of people we can label middle class, when the statistics actually show that the vast majority of people in this country are working class individuals. The commercial imperatives of the show also kind of pushed it in that direction. One of the things I mentioned briefly in the book is the shift in the advertising. In the early years, some of us old enough might remember that Bart Simpson was pitching Butterfinger candy bars, mm-hmm. and Burger King. And only after a couple of years, they were doing advertisement or receiving advertising dollars from MasterCard, from Intel, from, you know, a whole variety of things that are associated with a very different kind of work, a very different kind of lifestyle, a very different kind of income. So I think all three of those factors together, right, the writer's background, the audience desires, and the advertising dollars work to push this to seem more and more like a middle-class family and a middle-class sitcom than it actually is.
How has the show taken on LGBT identity over the years, and how have the positions that it takes tracked with the sort of expanding acceptance by Americans?
They have tracked it very well, and it's been very interesting. One of the early projects I did, this was back in the mid-1990s when I was in graduate school at the time, and very interested in the sexual politics of the show. Most fans of the show knew there were always these sort of, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of hints about Waylon Smithers.
Who loves Mr. Burns.
Who loves Mr. Burns. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, there was this, as I talk about in the book, this kind of camp aesthetic, this campy quality, lots of allusions to gay life, lots of subtle gay humor, innuendo, etc. And so I wanted to explore that a little bit and talk about why they were doing that. And I think it fit in very well with some of the trends, as you mentioned. During the 1990s, the Simpsons was just a little bit ahead of the curve, interestingly enough, in dealing with some of these things, because that didn't become more mainstream on network television, at any rate, until about 96, 97, 98, right, when you had the breakthroughs with Ellen and then with Will and Grace.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of it going on with the TV show Roseanne a little bit earlier, but not in a really consistent kind of way. So they were definitely trying to, I think, create this space for more visibility for gay and lesbian individuals. And this was very much a part of what was going on in the 1990s and part of the whole gay and lesbian civil rights movement that was gaining much more momentum was about gaining more visibility in the 1990s and doing that within various forms of mass media. Hollywood film, for example, a lot of independent film was doing it, but then the Hollywood studios started to latch onto that as well. So they were already there ahead of the curve a little bit. And then they continued to track it. Most importantly, I think, in one of my favorite episodes called There's Something About Marrying, which airs in 2005. And this is on the heels of the numerous debates going on over same-sex marriage in the country. We had seen the tension that's a part of the ongoing culture wars, this kind of push and pull between progressive and conservative forces, some states starting to pass either civil union legislation or same-sex marriage legislation, many other states adopting and following the DOMA law, or the Defense of Marriage Act, which was actually signed into law under Bill Clinton back in 1996, many of them adopting that in their state legislatures to ban same-sex marriage or the recognition of that from another state. And so the Simpsons was willing to step into the fray very vocally, very explicitly, I think, in that episode, much more openly and explicitly than they had in previous ones. And there's no mistaking the message that's being offered in that episode. They're absolutely in support of same-sex marriage, of those kinds of individual rights being granted.
Remind us of what happened there. Marge has these twin sisters, Selma and Patty,
yeah.
and one of the sisters decides she wants to marry.
Yeah, it was funny. In the lead-up to that episode, news had sort of leaked out that there was going to be an infamous coming out of one of the characters on The Simpsons. So they kind of fed that into the media system. There's a little meme going around.
So you think Smithers?
And most people did. And I remember taking bets with friends on who it was going to be. And some people said, oh, surely it'll be Smithers. And others like, no, they'll pull some odd thing out of a hat just to play with our heads. It actually was fairly logical. If you go back and look at the history of Patty, comments that she's made in other episodes. And anyway... The premise was that she had found somebody, fallen in love, and wanted to get married, and came to tell her sister about this. And the episode, in part, is dealing with Marge's resistance to that. Marge, who's otherwise, in many episodes, a very progressive-minded woman, overtly feminist in a lot of ways, very forward-thinking and forward-looking, tries to teach her daughter that, struggles a little bit. Not so much necessarily with her homophobia, but simply, I think, with the surprise of this, right, that it's so sudden that this hasn't been shared previously, you know, from her sister. But the way the episode plays out is, I find it very interesting, and I contrast it in the book to the way in which a television show like Will and Grace might have handled something like this. Because the writers for the show, they're very smart. They're very sophisticated in a lot of ways. And what they could have done in this situation is given us a comfortable, kind of heterosexualized and very happy ending. What happens is the woman that Patty has fallen in love with, who's named Robin, turns out to be a man in disguise. He had dressed as a woman, dressed in drag, in order to get onto the LPGA tour. And that's never really dealt with in a sophisticated way in the show, nor does it really need to be. But this is revealed at the end of the episode. And there's this very tender moment very close to the end of the episode where he's exposed, but he says, Patty, I'm still the person you fell in love with. Will you marry me? And there's this pause. And then she says, hell no, I like girls. And everybody,
so she doesn't have to compromise.
There's
we
no
know
compromise.
She's a lesbian and we're led to be okay with it.
And everybody who's there gathered for the wedding ceremony applauds this. And that's how the episode ends. It's really remarkable. And if you contrast that to something like Will and Grace, which worked so hard to heterosexualize the relationship, to downplay, this is of Will mm-hmm. in particular, to downplay his gayness, right? From the title of the show on down the line, right? Will and Grace. I mean, it's a very comfortable and comforting kind of narrative that show would offer that would mask the sexuality.
Sort of asexualized gay man.
Absolutely. And then, of course, it over-hypersexualized the other character, Jack, so mm-hmm. we could clearly recognize, well, he's the queer character, and we can somewhat dismiss yeah. him. We don't have to take him seriously. So putting those two things side by side, I think, was very telling about where we were at that time period in what network television was capable of doing. And here we saw Fox still pushing the envelope a little bit more.
Talk about the feminism of Marge Simpson as compared with the feminism of the next generation, Lisa Simpson.
With Marge, it's much more tempered. Marge is a fairly conflicted character in a lot of ways. She's got one foot in the past and one foot in the future. when you look over the series, you see a lot of references to before she met Homer. She was in college. She was on a different kind of career path, and very, very much a feminist. She was coming up of age in the 1970s, and there's references to her being involved in marches and reading Ms. Magazine and lots of other things. But here she is, you know, in the contemporary age now, a mother of three, a suburban housewife, and she's kind of given herself over to that domestic role and primarily stays in that domestic space unless the show wants to challenge some things about gender, about sexism in the culture, and then they kind of put her out of that. Lisa's a very different story. Lisa is, from the start, very progressive-minded, overtly feminist, and, I mean, pretty progressive-minded on every other topic as well. And the nice thing about it is there's a continuity because you see very often that it's Marge who's given her that. Marge has helped craft that mindset for her daughter. Lisa, being part of the generation she is, I think, has the freedom to run with it. Being unmarried, you know, being a child, allows her this kind of freedom as well. But I find Marge fascinating. I think it's really interesting how the writers of the show have dealt with issues about women in the workplace, for example, by taking Marge out of the home and putting her into spaces that have been previously dominated by men. One of the episodes I talk about is the Springfield Connection, which she desires to become a police officer. And that coincided, again, with a lot of debate going on in the 1990s about women moving into these kinds of spaces. There was a great deal of resistance to women becoming police officers, firefighters, serving in the military, serving in combat in the military, and even the attempt to integrate the Virginia Military Institute and the Citadel. You remember some of the lawsuits around that and the scandals surrounding that. And so, again, you know, the show is very good at reflecting these kind of cultural shifts, these battles and debates that are going on. And so they put Marge into that position and they allow her to contest that patriarchal or sexist mindset. But then they often put her back into the domestic space because it's fairly comfortable.
It's still a sitcom. You got to kind of end up at square one.
Very often.
Matthew A. Henry is here. He's professor of English and Cultural Studies at Richland College and author of the new book, The Simpsons, Satire and American Culture. We'll come back to our discussion in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us and ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Matthew A. Henry. He's professor of English and Cultural Studies at Richland College and author of the book The Simpsons, Satire, and American Culture. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. It's interesting, you can find people who point to The Simpsons as a great example of family values because they go to church every week, and you can find people who say that is not the point that the show is trying to make. Talk about where you land on this, and there is sort of a complex relationship in the show between secularism and religion and what it all means in their lives and to the extent to which their moral compass is set by their participation in church.
Yeah. I was just speaking with my class this morning about this. They're right now in the midst of writing a paper, their final paper for the semester, on the theme or the topic of religion and how The Simpsons portrays that and whether the show, in their interpretation, is offering a more supportive and institutional religious perspective or more of a secular and philosophical perspective. So I don't want to prejudice or bias my students too much by talking about it. But we were looking at part of an episode today, a very famous one, a lot of people have written about, called Homer the Heretic. And in that episode, Homer decides he's no longer going to attend church. And it's a very interesting episode. It appeared in 1992. And so at that time, it was still a relatively controversial kind of thing to be dealing with. Most television sitcoms don't deal with religion at all anyway. It's an absence. You know, you don't see people visibly going to church. You don't see them praying. It's not part of a conversation. On The Simpsons, from the start, it's been very foregrounded, which makes it quite unique. It's one of the reasons why I think some scholars looked at the show and said, well, they're very much in support of this kind of Christian ethos because it's so evident on the show. Mm-hmm. My take is that it's evident for a different purpose. It's evident for the purposes of satire most of the time. In this particular episode, though, we were at the end of it. Homer, series of circumstances, he's convinced or persuaded to go back to church. And so one of the final scenes is we see him, you know, sitting front and center in a pew, sleeping and snoring very loudly. So, you know, it raises questions about, well, how do you interpret something like that? Is this, again, kind of satirically poking fun at the idea that people are simply going through the motions of religion only to conform to the expectation to fit into that kind of McWasp identity they're expected to? Or, you know, is he actually a person of faith and this is just how he behaves and we just, you know, kind of accept that? I happen to think it's more the former. I think that this is something the writers of the show, many of whom, if you look back at interviews with them, are self-professed either atheists or Jews, or some call themselves failed or recovering Catholics, a variety of different things. And I think they don't have a lot of patience with religious fundamentalism. And that's very different from saying they don't have patience with mainstream faith or belief or Christianity. There is a very strong theme in the show. Marge is a good example of this, too. I mean, even in this episode, Homer the Heretic, she's very much aligned with the church and with the community in that. And there's something very sincere about that. There is for Lisa early on in the show as well. Although, interestingly, Lisa at one point, I can't remember what year it was, leaves Christianity and becomes a Buddhist. And she remains so. It's a very interesting thing to happen on a show in which no one ever ages, right? Mm-hmm. No one ever gets any older, but we've been on for 24 years, and yet that was something that changed in a particular episode and stays changed in later episodes. So it's kind of a clear statement on the part of the writers that a more spiritual kind of philosophy like Buddhism might be preferable, especially for someone like Lisa, who is the embodiment of intellect, of enlightenment, of progressivism.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. First, I just wanted to thank you, Chris, for having Matt on. He was a former teacher of mine at Richland and he's a wonderful guy. Glad his book is out. And I just wanted to ask if he thought that The Simpsons in more recent years has become less biting with their satire. They become more pop culture and I mean, just if they've changed their sort of rigor in terms of making comments.
Well, thank you for the question. I do think that the satire has waned over the years. And it's almost probably expected that it would. That early cohort of writers, people who were associated with Harvard and the Harvard Lampoon, We're coming right out of the gate with some very sharp satire. But that's a hard thing to sustain. And as the show became more popular, as it became more commercial, I think the pressures were there to make it less controversial in some ways and more mainstream. Plus, you had a changing stable of writers, right? Because people would be with it for a few years and then a new writer would come along and they bring different sets of kind of expectations or desires and what they want to achieve. One of the things I talk about in the book are these kinds of peaks and valleys. Most scholars and most fans, I think, look at the first 7-8 seasons of the show as the classic years at this point. The satire was sharp, it was consistent, it was quite regular. And then there was quite a bit of a falling off, and a lot of fans were very turned off. I myself tuned out around season 10 or so, kind of lost interest. Other things were taking up the new position. In 97, South Park came along, and South Park, because it had a freedom on Comedy Central, which was on cable rather than network television, could push that envelope much further. And they could be in some ways satiric, or they could also be much more scatological and much more simply aggressive, in your face. That kind of humor was appealing to many people, maybe to many younger audiences. By comparison, it might make The Simpsons look a little bit tame. But I think there was a time, and there have been a couple of these, where The Simpsons kind of returns to form because of changes in the culture, because they're addressing some of these culture war issues. So, for example, we mentioned before the episode, There's Something About Marrying. That episode, which was responding to many of the things that were happening in the election cycle of 2004, was, as I said before, overtly satirical and overt and direct in the point that it was trying to make about same-sex relations. And so, you know, I was very happy to see that kind of return to a satirical stance. And that has been true in many of the seasons, although much less consistently. Whereas in the early years, I could feel safe that, you know, 8 out of 10 episodes I looked at would be wonderfully satirical. These days, I'd be lucky if it's maybe 2 or 3 out of 10.
How does The Simpsons treat American identity? I mean, you have characters coming from other places. There is for some sort of troublesome character of Apu, who mm-hmm. runs the Quickie Mart. Talk a little bit about what the show wants to say about the meaning of American identity.
I think the show very much wants to embrace a multiculturalism, a pluralistic perspective. One of the things I talk about with my students, I write about it in the book a little bit, it goes back to your question before about WASP and McWASP identity. Hand in hand with that is my own frustration with and challenge to the longstanding metaphor of the melting pot. And I tell my students, and I try not to be too frustrated with this, but every year, I really dislike that metaphor.
Are you a tossed salad guy, or is there a better way of looking at this?
Tossed salad is okay. I've kind of settled on mosaic. Mm-hmm. I like mosaic. I don't remember who I got that from, but I really like the idea of, you know, all these various little multicolored parts make up this whole, which is a larger, beautiful picture. Nice metaphor for America. Mm-hmm. A melting pot is a way of making everything conform and assimilate to one thing. And that's where that old Anglo-Saxon identity used to be at the fore, right? This is part of the assimilationist ethos. I don't think The Simpsons embraces that at all. I think they overtly reject this. Part of it is by incorporating a multiplicity of races and ethnicities just in the characters of the show. I mean, Springfield itself is as diverse a place as you can find, and it's a reflection of many, many American cities. And then the way in which they deal with characters like Apu, for example, one of the most famous episodes called Much Apu About Nothing, which aired in 1996, was responding to a lot of nativist and anti-immigrant sentiment going on in the country at the time. There was a very famous bill passed in California, particularly strongly supported in Southern California, about Mexican immigration. And The Simpsons kind of spoke back to that. They incorporated into this episode their own proposition in the town of Springfield to get rid of illegal immigrants, and it turns out Apu is one of them. And it raises questions, you know, because they're emotional questions now, because the Simpsons know him, he's a friend, and how are they going to deal with this? And there's a wonderfully telling scene in there where Apu at first attempts to assimilate. And he puts on all the trappings of what he thinks American identity is. He puts on a cowboy hat, a baseball outfit, he plays country music, and he changes his accent. Oh, and he gets rid of his statue of Ganesh, mm-hmm. right, to conform. It only lasts for a short moment on the episode. By the end of the episode, he says, I can't do that. I can't. That's not being true to myself. And Lisa, interestingly, helps him find another way to secure his citizenship, which he does, and does remarkably well.
Why are the Simpsons yellow?
The Simpsons are yellow for a number of reasons. I talk a lot in one of the chapters of the book about the history of this. Some people see it as a kind of accident of coloring. Others think one of the colorists, one of the original colorists for the show, misunderstood that there was a desire to make make a multicultural palette, but they wanted to use something that would stand out rather strongly and sharply, so this bright yellow color. The way I interpret it is that yellow is simply a proxy for whiteness, that the yellow characters are meant to be understood as white American characters because all those non-white characters are colored differently.
There's some brown.
Other yeah. shade of brown. And so this comes up most interestingly very recently in an episode, fascinating episode called The Color Yellow, which aired in 2010. And when I saw that episode, what's remarkable about it, if listeners don't know of this episode, is that by the end of it, we discover a different alternative history for the Simpsons family, one that involves African-American ancestry. And so it turns out that Bart and Lisa are 1/64th black. Now, that might shock some listeners. Right? Never heard of such a thing, right? This comes on the heels of the election of Barack Obama and the heels of conversations about a so-called post-racial America, mm-hmm. on conversations about biracial, triracial identity, on changes to the census that are allowing people for the first time to identify more than one race category. I mean, all these ways this, in which we racial and ethnic identity is much more fluidly understood than it had been in the past. And so I think, you know, creating the characters this unearthly yellow color was a way of giving them the looseness to play with these kinds of identities. And they do it really quite well. This episode, I thought, was rather brave and kind of bold in taking a stance a stance against white privilege at a time when certain factions of the electorate are having conniption fits over the first American, black American president and attempting to question his authenticity, right?
I know that the show is seen all over the world, and there are some jokes within it that seem as if they would not make much sense outside of this country. Do you know about the reception of The Simpsons overseas? Have you looked at that at all?
I have not done much research into the reception in other countries. The only thing I can speak of is my own personal experience. 2 years ago, I was on a Fulbright teaching at a university in Germany. I was there for a full academic year, and I taught the course that I teach at Richland, The Simpsons and American Culture, as part of the American Studies program over there. I had a lot of conversations with German students about the reception of the show. Now, these students, of course, are fluent in English.
Right.
They've learned it from a very young age. And so they get most of the jokes that might be sort of lost in translation for people whose English language skills are perhaps not quite as good, or for people who haven't been immersed as fully in American popular culture. Mm-hmm. Germany is. I mean, they get all of the stuff that comes out of Hollywood, and they get it fairly quickly. So they got most of the jokes. There wasn't much loss. There wasn't much cultural difference there. I would imagine, though, in many other parts of the world, there would be a much greater gap. It would be hard to translate certain ideas.
The last thing I want to ask you about is whether your students see the title of the course in the catalog and think, this is going to be great, this is going to be my easiest course, and then come in and find that it is much more challenging to really look at this show in the ways that you do, and whether they are honest with you about that surprise, or what do you know about that?
Some of them have been honest about it. Many of them do know what it is when they sign up for it. Some of them don't, though. I mean, some students are signing up for, it's a time slot, it fits their schedule, this will fulfill a credit. They don't necessarily read what the course description is. I would like to think, though, that most of my students think that the course certainly is challenging, mm-hmm. for them. If they did come into it with the expectation that we're just going to kick back and watch TV, they've been otherwise enlightened.
Matthew A. Henry is professor of English and Cultural Studies at Richland College. His new book is called The Simpsons, Satire and American Culture. Matt, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think, where you can also download the podcast. Comments, questions, and suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.